This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. This weekend, stoners will mark an annual holiday that is really more of a meme than a holiday. The origins of 420 are murky, but it likely came into being back in 1971 when a group of high school students in California, of course it was California, set a regular afternoon appointment to meet up after school and smoke. The Grateful Dead became involved, it's a long story, and teenage slang became legend. Marijuana is, of course, a different beast in 2024 than it was in the early 70s, in terms of who uses it, legality, even in terms of the makeup of the plant itself. Activists herald an era of progress and an era of increasing ubiquity for what is still technically a Schedule I drug. But through the smokescreen of weed's cultural impact and demonstrated promise as a therapeutic drug, there are public health professionals who aren't sure we're doing this right.
We are not taking the industry seriously enough, and then we are not taking the drug seriously enough and are thus using it in reckless ways without enough regard to how it can be harmful.
Keith Humphreys of Stanford joins Hear Me Out in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. Legal marijuana is popular. As of late 2023, 70% of Americans think weed should be legal. That's a big change from past years. In 1969, for example, 82% of us thought it should be illegal. We rarely see that kind of consensus on anything in this country. Plus, it's clear that decriminalizing and legalizing marijuana is associated with significant criminal justice reform. But as weed advocates celebrate slow but definite progress toward making pot legal nationwide, some public health experts are sounding the alarm. They say the way this is happening could cause damage to society and lives. Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University and joins us now. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Nice to talk with you.
You too. For those who don't know you, tell us what you do.
I'm a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University, where I study addiction of all different sorts and recovery from addiction. I've also done some work with treatment, prevention, and policy. I worked, for example, for President Obama in the White House as senior drug policy advisor.
Okay, so let's start with just a clear articulation of what your view is. So give us the elevator pitch of what you think is wrong with legalizing marijuana.
Yeah, well, to be clear, I've never always said it would be a terrible idea to throw somebody in a cell for using marijuana. So it's nothing about that. What I would say is going on is we are not taking the industry seriously enough, and as a result are regulating far too weakly. And then we are not taking the drug seriously enough and are thus using it in reckless ways without enough regard to how it can be harmful. Those are the two things, yeah.
You're not saying you think weed should be illegal.
No, not at all. I mean, the commission in California that gave advice to the state on legalization, the steering committee was myself, the head of the ACLU, and Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor. So, and we provided, you know, my view is like, democracy matters. People want to be able to use this. And so I felt the role was to explain how do you have this happen in such a way that there's maximal benefit and minimal harm. And I think we haven't done that. But, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, that's what people want to do.
One of the things that you talk about and have written about is the fact that we shouldn't destigmatize drug use, which isn't the same as, you know, legalization. But it sounds like you're saying that there should be a stigma associated with using weed. Is that correct?
We definitely, right now, I'd say the normative view is, you know, weed is, not only is it not harmful in any way, but that it cures everything. I mean, you know, it helps with sleep, it helps with anxiety, it helps with depression, you should smoke it during pregnancy and all these kinds of things. And that is a ridiculously rosy appraisal of what this drug is, especially in this the current drug. And, you know, should say, I don't know what age your listeners are, but some people will think of, oh, I remember cannabis from college. You had to smoke it for hours to get even slightly high. That's way in the past. So the current drug, you know, the average potency of flower is about 20, 25%. The other products, dabs and things, go up 60, 70, 80%. It's really potent and it has risk to it. So to the extent saying, you know, that is not harmless and in fact can hurt you is stigmatizing, then that is an absolutely reasonable thing to do. Likewise, on the health side, many promises made, this is going to reverse the opioid epidemic once we start using this more. I mean, how did that turn out? I mean, we you know, the opioid epidemic's gotten worse side by side. Or this is something that you should use in preference to treatments with better evidence of effectiveness. Those things are untrue, and I think we need to say they're untrue. And to the extent you could say that's a disapproving message, okay, then in that sense, I'm comfortable being disapproving.
Because on the other hand, there's the scientific opinion on this is not in consensus. You know, we had a study of teens that was done between 1993 and 2017. It found that use of marijuana declined by nearly 10% when recreational use of weed was made legal. And also there have been, I don't need to tell you, but our audiences might not know that there were two large studies that showed about a 25% decrease in deaths from opiate overdose, correlated, not caused, but correlated with the legalization of medical cannabis.
Okay, so two things. Your first claim is that the evidence on does legalization affect teen use? I didn't say anything about that. But what I would say is, what is the impact of using when in your teen years cannabis versus not? And there is no scientific dispute about kids who use a lot of cannabis versus kids who do not, that, you know, in terms of their health and their success in school and so on. That opioid study, which was very famous, done around 2010, and Weed Maps put it on billboards all over the country. This will reduce the opioid overdose rate.
Yeah.
Well, a subsequent study led by, you know, my colleague Chelsea Shover, with using the same methods but 7 years more data, showed that that pattern actually reversed over time. And the industry never acknowledged this, but nonetheless, that did not hold up. And also, we just got to say, let's look at our society. Cannabis use has gone up dramatically in the last 20 years. Opioid overdoses have gone up dramatically in the last 20 years. If more and more cannabis use is going to stop the opioid crisis, you got to wonder how many decades do we have to wait for that to happen? I think we can say pretty confidently that that is not true.
Although, I mean, you're in the psychological field. One of the problems isn't necessarily drug use. It's the reasons why people pick up drugs, right? Like the declining life expectancy in the United States, doctors have said the biggest cause is despair. And that can also drive drug use as well, as a mostly, you know, a questionably effective way of coping with anxiety and stress and depression.
Well, I'm certainly in favor of good mental health, for sure. And you're absolutely right that bad mental health, stress, depression, loneliness can all spur the use of substances. And at the same time, we don't use substances that aren't available, and we use the substances that are most available more. So there was a heck of a lot of stress and depression in 2008 during the financial crisis. There were no fentanyl deaths. Why not? Because fentanyl wasn't out there. That's why. I mean, so, you know, the sadness alone can't produce these things without the availability of the drugs. And that's why, you know, it's, although sadness may make drug use worse, it doesn't mean we should say, well, I guess we shouldn't do anything to limit people's exposure to drugs since it's all driven by mental health. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
On the other hand, fentanyl is not the same as weed. I mean, weed has been available and
I'm just saying that to illustrate the point. I could have picked anything, yeah. Automatic weapons is another thing. People are angry when they commit mass shootings. Absolutely true. On the other hand, if they didn't have easy access to automatic weapons, anger wouldn't translate into mass shootings as easily.
I mean, it's a fair point, but on the other hand, it could very well be that the legalization of marijuana is not being done in the best way. On the other hand, the weed that was available on the streets that was not in any way, shape, or form regulated or taxed, you know, pharmacologists found traces of E. coli bacteria in it, Aspergillus fungus. They found that a lot of it that was sold on the streets had dangerous levels of fecal material. So, I mean, isn't that progress, that at least we can regulate for that?
except we're not regulating at all. I mean, you know, hardly any state or city has any cap on the potency of the products. Every audit that has been done of labeling has shown that labeling is terrible and frequently inaccurate. So yeah, theoretically, I agree. You know, a nice tightly regulated industry like, say, we have with milk, you know, would be much better than a Wild West. But we have a Wild West. So, you know, I'm all in favor of it. I guess it's easy to be in favor of a world we don't have and say, but the world we do have. When's the last time you saw any consequence for the industry for mislabeling something or mispromoting something? It just hasn't really happened. And by the way, we also still have a massive, massive illicit market in cannabis, and which is another promise of legalization that hasn't been realized and I think should be considered a policy failure.
We're about to take a break, but, you know, I have to say I live in North Bethesda, Maryland, so there's a lot of people around me that work for the NIH. And one of the things they could not stop talking about was that now that weed is legal in Maryland, it's no longer illegal to study cannabidiol, for example. Cannabidiol is not associated with getting a high. It's not, as far as we know, addictive, but it has lots of possibly really beneficial properties, antipsychotic properties, anti-seizure, and scientists have been wanting to study it for a long time. Legalization makes that possible.
Oh, now cannabidiol has been studied for many, many years. You can still study illegal drugs. I have plenty of colleagues who do it. We have colleagues who are studying cocaine, MDMA, hallucinogens. So that doesn't necessarily follow that you have to have a licit market of people selling something for scientists to study it. You do need the right kind of policy set up, and we could certainly do better on that on lots of drugs. But I don't, you know, it doesn't follow because we needed to study CBD, there have to be 10,000 illegal pot shops in New York City. This is not so.
Okay, we're going to take a break and we'll come back to this discussion about whether or not we are legalizing marijuana the right way. This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee and we will return. And we're back. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. And today we're talking about legal weed. Not whether it should be legal, but whether we're doing it all wrong. And my guest is Keith Humphreys, a professor of psychiatry at Stanford and also was a drug policy advisor for both the second President Bush and Barack Obama. So let's go back to this idea of the right way to legalize weed. It seems to me that it's always going to go in steps, right? Like, anytime you do something suddenly, whether it's a ban or a lift of a ban, say prohibition, when it's done all at once, it seems to always cause problems.
Yes.
And so maybe that's the real issue here, that instead it should have been incremental?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we are very herky-jerky in our policy in the United States on a million different things. It seems like we treat what ought to be thought of as a series of dials as a series of switches. Like, we have to do this, or we have to do the drug. We have to have a war on drugs, or we have to do absolutely nothing about drugs at all and sell them on every street corner when there's a lot of space in between. The challenge is that when you do what we've done with cannabis, where we've had an industry created that has got a lot of money. Once that happens, it's very hard to change the policy further because of how our political system works. Just that it'd be very tough to say, you know, restrict alcohol because you would have an industry right there to stop you. The cannabis industry could probably stop much of the adjustments that you might like to make. So that would have been a case for doing this differently from the first, but I think it's hard to undo it for those states that already have, you know, a lobbying army set to thwart any policy provision.
I mean, I totally understand that a pharmacological decision should be made carefully. It should be made slowly and deliberatively. On the other hand, being fully aware, as you are, of the racial disparities in how weed was criminalized, the fact that African Americans are nearly four times likely to be arrested for marijuana even though they have this, they consume it at the same, about the same rate as whites. That to me argues for a sudden legalization. That would say, why would we wait to legalize this while people, especially BIPOC people, are sitting in prison for it?
Well, my understanding is that we're not arguing about legalization. We're arguing about how to do it. So you could have said, like Quebec did or Uruguay did, we are going to have state stores where we sell this product, kind of like we used to have state stores for alcohol. It's immediately available. Anybody can buy it if they want to, where, you know, wherever they want to. However, we won't have promotions. We won't have advertising. We will do ID checks, and there'll be government employees selling it. And by the way, the government is a far more diverse workforce than the private sector workforce.
That's true.
One of the stories of the cannabis industry is that they have talked about racial justice up and down. Don't worry, when it's legalized, we're so upset about all this stuff. Look who runs the industry. It's white as the driven snow. So they have zero commitment to diversity at the top, and you know, if that that's would have been a really strong case for having this done with state stores.
So, you know, although Canada is a capitalist country, that it has a lot more embrace of its socialist side, I think, than the United States. I mean, I think it would be very difficult because the chance of making money from cannabis is so tempting, I think it would be hard to get people to allow the government to handle its sale and not run it. I mean, America is
that, now you're,
all in on capitalism.
Right. Now you're getting to the nub of it, and this is, I think, where we agree. What has happened is we have prioritized money, profit, over public health. And where there's many other areas where Americans actually agree that we should prioritize public health over, you know, if we were allowed to sell cigarettes to little kids, you could make a lot of money. But we've all agreed, nah, that doesn't seem right. I mean, there's more important things than making money. We put restrictions on, you know, we don't sell alcohol to kids, same thing. So, you know, we can make that decision. And the California Commission that I was on with Gavin Newsom, that was our recommendation, is don't think about this fundamentally as how do we maximize profit? Because with drugs, the way you maximize profit is you get it as much as available, you promote it as much as possible, and you try to addict as many people as possible because they're the heaviest consumers. Whereas in public health, you would structure things in a way to try to reduce all those harms, still have the industry, you don't have anybody being arrested for using or selling. But you don't get the public health damage that you get when you just say, hey, go for the bucks.
So, I mean, I think we do agree on this. In fact, as the more that we talk, I'm realizing we agree on a lot more than I would have expected.
I hope this doesn't ruin your show.
No.
Okay.
It happens. Not often, but it happens that I end up with a guest agreeing more than I disagree. But I, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm nothing if not cynical about our governmental processes and the way that laws are made. And, you know, if we're talking, again, like you say, if we're talking about what I wish the world were and what it is, I don't know if it's possible for weed to have been legalized the way you want it to, the way that would protect human well-being, mental health, and physical health.
If we gave into cynicism, though, and if think about racial justice, we would never have had Black Lives Matter as a movement. We would never have pushed back. We'd just say, oh, it's a racist country. No one can do anything about it. We never would have had a civil rights movement. Well, you know, it's inherently racist. Nothing can do about it. We never would have tried to get equitable treatment for women in the workplace. Oh, it's a sexist country. You can't do anything about it. I just think that cynicism can be a way of giving up on things that are really, really worth fighting for. And one of those things is public health. So yeah, I know it's hard. And yes, you know, I've worked in politics. No one has to tell me about the influence of money, but I'm not willing to just say, well, you got to let companies do whatever they feel like because this is America. It's like, you know, America has never gotten better by someone who looked at it that way, entirely through cynicism without any hope.
On the other hand, companies do get away with a lot. And the more that we see the way that the judicial process happens, the more it can make somebody feel frustrated that. And I wonder
if Of course. I feel frustrated too, obviously. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have put that much effort into designing models where this legalization could reduce harm if I didn't, you know, and then I'm very disappointed because we have not done that as a country. And I tell friends in other countries who are legalizing, whatever you do, don't look at us. Look at Canada. Look at Uruguay. Maybe now look at Germany. They've legalized. You're not going to get a public health oriented model, at least certainly not the best model out of the U.S. at the national level. Of course, states still have options, right? So there could be states that, you know, including some states who used to have state stores for alcohol, could choose to do something different and be an example of different ways to do things.
Before I get to complaints I have about the legalization process, where I assume you might agree with me, let me just ask you if you think these monsters are already out of Pandora's box. Is it too late to fix the way cannabis has been legalized?
So the argument that was made prior to legalization was by many people is, well, we're going to make really loose regulation now, but don't worry, we can tighten it up later. And I said at the time, that's really athwart the history of corporate industry in the United States. The easiest time to regulate is before that industry is big and rich. Once it's big and rich, it's really hard to tighten up. So you are right that the best opportunity we had was prior to legalization to set up a really strong framework. At the same time, federally, we haven't legalized yet, and a lot of states haven't legalized yet. So in those cases, we do have the option to set things up more intelligently than we did in places where we just said, you know, tell you what, let's have the industry say jump and we'll ask how high.
I agree with that. And the other thing that I think you might agree with me on is the fact that the legalization of marijuana is not fixing the criminal justice system in the way people think it is. Statistics show that between 2001 and 2010, Black people were 273% more likely to be arrested for possessing marijuana. And now that we've had a lot of states legalize it, Black people are 264% more likely to be arrested for possession.
So I honestly think you should really be mad at activists for a lot of this stuff, because there were a bunch of people, and I was one of them, who said this in advance. This was a false promise. I mean, it's like, you know, that prisons, I heard this over and again, our prison system is full of people who are just there for smoking pot. I've spent a lot of time in prisons in my career. That is not who is in prison at all. Whether you think that it was good or bad legalized pot, that's never going to change the prison population. You know, people there are there for very serious crimes, usually multiple crimes committed over many, many years. So it's easy to say, I'm really against mass incarceration because I want to let that kid who went to Princeton, who volunteers down at the church, not serve 20 years for smoking a joint. Just like, that's not real life. And cannabis legalization was oversold on that basis, on a decarceration basis, and also undermined the efforts to decarcerate by telling a lot of people that all you had to do was legalize pot. Don't worry about reforming the sentencing for violence, for example. And then you've done something great, when in fact they did nothing. It was a meaningless gesture that undermined the hard work of real reform around decarceration.
Okay, on that note of agreement, we're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation about what is the best way to legalize marijuana and whether we're doing it. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate, and we will be right back. And we're back. This is Hear Me Out. Thanks for staying with us. We're talking today about legal weed because our guest believes we are not legalizing weed in the right way, in a way that would protect public health, safety, and the future of society, I guess. And on that note, you know, before the break, I asked you if the monsters were already out of Pandora's box. Now let me put you the opposite question. Perhaps it's not quite as dire as we might be led to think. Maybe this is the way legislation always works in the United States, in which they make a change, they realize it's causing particular problems, and then it gets tweaked. So maybe that's what we're in the process of.
Well, yeah, I'd like to think that, you know, it can be a long slog. If you compare it to like the tobacco industry, of course, pretty much got its way for a very, very long time, and everyone was afraid to confront them. But eventually some, you know, early adopters of a public health approach took the risk, got things going. It still took decades to get decent taxes, to get ads off TV, all that sort of stuff. I think we are not. Public health is in a weird defensive crouch about cannabis, is one of the interesting things about cannabis. It has all this cultural meaning to people, by which I mean that in a lot of public health departments, if cannabis were alcohol or tobacco, they would be raising the alarm. But the average public health officials think, oh, I don't want to sound like a blue rinse mom from the 1980s. I don't want to be anti-weed. I'm cool. And so they have not been out there in front at the level you would expect, given, you know, how they normally react to an industry that sells an addictive drug. So I think that's going to take a while. It's going to take a while to people realize, oh, there is still harm here. Oh, I have an obligation. Oh, I think of myself as liberal. I guess I don't really believe in the idea that anything a wealthy company wants to do is fine as long as they're making money. That sort of cultural change needs to happen. And also people need to get an awareness of who the industry is. You know, before legalization, a lot of people imagined, well, the industry is going to be really gentle, sweet hippies, and they're going to be brooding over their plants and setting aside 10% to save the whales. Just like, no, it's going to be Wall Street. It's going to be MBAs and lawyers and people who know how to maximize profit and Madison Avenue who knows how to advertise. But that hasn't been fully baked into people's heads yet. They're still thinking like, well, the cannabis industry would never do anything wrong because, you know, cannabis is about goodness and peace and all that. So that consciousness needs to develop, which I see happening more and more, but it's going to take a while.
So then I wonder, let me ask if you think there are other and higher priorities. And I say that because, you know, look, I recently did a three-year-long investigation into the sugar industry, and sugar is really bad for your health. I mean, the top two leading causes of death in the United States are heart disease and cancer. Both are strongly associated with the overconsumption of sugar. Eating too much sugar causes heart disease, some cancers. It's associated with diabetes. It's killing people. And we don't seem to be worried about that at all. We subsidize the sugar industry. So, is the legalization of weed our highest priority?
I think you could point out other terrible things. I mean, you know, weed's not going to destroy the planet. Climate change might. It bothers me that there are more guns than people in our country. I mean, there's one of my favorite quotes is, you know, more than one thing can be sad. They could all be bad. We can, and also we're capable clearly of working on more than one thing at once. It may also be true with addictions that we get some spillover benefit. In other words, you know, it's very common for people, if they get addicted to one thing, to then get addicted to other things. So it could be the things we do, you know, that can, you know, limit the number of people who become really heavy cannabis smokers might also limit, you know, the number who pick up other, you know, bad health habits. So maybe, you know, the things you're working on with sugar could actually help things with cannabis or things with other drugs.
Which just leads me back as we wrap our conversation here. I'm kind of led back over and over again to capitalism, and I have to wonder if the urge to make money is kind of at the heart of everything that we're talking about. Because again, the overuse of sugar is largely because of a chasing profits on the part of the sugar barons. One of the biggest problems with legalizing weed, as you describe it, is the fact that it became a profit-generating industry before it was, you know, pharmacologically safe. I mean, is that what do you think? Is this the problem really the strength of capitalism in this country?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think addictive drugs are the ultimate capitalist product because people will spend. Even as other things are being destroyed. I mean, we see that with all these drugs. So
even alcohol.
Alcohol. Yeah. And they aren't, it's not alcohol, tobacco, cocaine, you know, they're not ordinary commodities. So I'm actually fine with capitalism when it comes to like lettuce. I like lettuce. You know, lettuce is in the store. It seems to be clean. It's pretty cheap. Capitalism markets seem to work pretty well. But I don't know that capitalism, unrestrained capitalism, works very well with addictive products. And so that means to me, not, it doesn't make me want to become, you know, a socialist, but it does make me want to say, ah, I'd like to have some really tight regulation over this, because I don't think, you know, sugar and cannabis go in the same bin as lettuce in terms of how I think about products. And, you know, I think we can do that. We've done it with other products that, you know, we do that. We're doing that to some extent now with fossil fuels. We've done that with tobacco. We need to apply that reasoning to cannabis as well.
I will say, though, since you mentioned lettuce, that it's more likely to cause a salmonella outbreak or even sometimes E. coli than
meat. Now you've ruined lettuce for me.
And there's a disparity also between the quality of lettuce in low-income communities versus high-income, because the low-income ones are way more likely to have staphylococcus and
you have
fecal matter. And
so you will be glad to know you have now won an argument and changed my mind. I am now anti-lettuce.
Sorry, it's the cynical generalist in me that I have to ruin everything.
Dang it.
Well, I mean, this is the end of the conversation. I think it's a really interesting one, and I'm glad that you're out there talking about it, because I don't think enough people are thinking about giving this as much thought, including the legislators who are making decisions on these laws. And I hope that you can inspire people to talk about it more.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate your passion and intelligence, and I enjoyed the conversation very much.
Me too. Have a great one.
You too. Take care.
We always want to know what you think. And look, anytime we're talking about weed or addiction, there are going to be a lot of opinions out there. So email your opinion to us. We want to hear it. It's hearmeout@slate.com. Last week, we had Jamila Lemieux on the show. She was talking about mixed race relationships and whether the rise in those relationships means society is less racist. You all had some really interesting responses to that episode. So before we go, we wanted to share one of them. This is a really thoughtful email that came to us from a listener named David. David says this: I was motivated to address Ms. Lemieux's comments because I worry about what other younger listeners in happy relationships may choose to do if her views remain unopposed. I started writing this at about 4:30 a.m. with my wife of about 30 years asleep beside me. I was woken by a splinter in my foot from work the previous day. She noticed me on my phone and sent me to get the tweezers. About 10 minutes later, she'd gotten the little bastard out. I've done similar for her on many occasions. That's the point of our marriage. Enduring love, not grand racial equality schemes. Yes, when we were engaged, interracial marriage was still technically illegal in one last state, not ours, and interracial marriages were still rare, though not remarkable. It didn't make me love her any more or less. I have a lot more to say about Ms. Lemieux's generalizations about marriages such as ours. Her qualifying her prejudices with words like "a lot of" didn't make them less hurtful. But I need to cut this email short to make breakfast for my wife. And David, that is just about the sweetest possible way you could have pushed back on any guest's opinions. So thank you for that, not only for the email, but for that lovely picture of a beautiful marriage. And again, we love hearing from you, whether your story is sweet or less sweet. So let us know what's on your mind. It's hearmeout@slate.com. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I am your host, Celeste Headley, and until next time, I hope you speak your mind, but keep it open.